This is David Owen Norris with a talk with musical examples called Elgar's Pianistic Iconoclasm, which I gave on December the 14th, 2007 at Gresham College as part of the Elgar and Modernism Conference. In childhood, Elgar used the piano to play continuo from a Vivaldi figured bass and to improvise. Rosa Burley tells us he played a sort of continuo with school ensembles in 1891. His improvisations in later life were famous for their orchestral effect. We can hear something of this in the third of the improvisations he recorded straight under hot wax in November 1929. Those fingers sound as if the piano's quite familiar to them, but what they're playing is difficult to notate. There's a danger that writing it down will tame it, and it'll end up sounding like this. The habit of inventing orchestral keyboard effects that can't be notated, and a familiarity with the freedoms of continuo playing, may well enlarge horizons beyond a normal, schooled manner of writing for the piano. Elgar's very original approach to the instrument is most clearly demonstrated in his frequent staccato bass lines. Many pianists carelessly bind these together with the sustaining pedal. Yet Elgar makes his wishes clear. In A Soldier's Song of 1884, or at any rate in its 1903 reprinting as A War Song, the first two bars invite pedal. But both bars have copious rests and dagger staccato marks, and pedal is actually marked in the third bar. The dot staccato marks in this third pedaled bar may be considered indications of touch within a pedal. The last bar of the page shows an insistence on staccato with dots, rests, and the word stack. The danger of attributing a system to any composer's use of the pedal, however, is shown in the second line of the second page, where an unequivocally long pedal incorporates dagger staccatos, which cannot therefore automatically mean no pedal. It's worth pointing to a difference between the first and second choruses, each accompanied by repeated triplet quaver chords. The first chorus marks the first Crotchetsworth with staccato dots in left and right hand, and puts a pedal mark a couple of bars later. The assumption is that the beginning of the chorus is unpedaled. The second chorus, mezzo forte rather than piano, has neither staccato marks nor subsequent pedal marks, allowing the assumption that the pedal should be used. An example of the care Elgar took to vary repeated phrases. This also explains the addition of pedal to a dominant restatement of the opening bars, originally unpedaled. The most striking example of this variation is in the composer's bowings in the introduction and allegro, where repeated phrases, like those in the viola's Welsh tune, are bowed in such a way that the repeat is upside down. All the library parts of the piece that I've looked at have corrected Elgar's bowing in pencil. The lengthy ballad As I Lay A-Thinking, composed in 1887, again establishes a staccato accompanimental figure before adding pedal to emphasise a harmony. The words are, "There seemed a crimson plain." At the foot of the the same page, the piano has a bassless staccato texture, which may have its origin in an imagination soaked in clarinets and flutes, but which the piano can make its own with great effect. As well as unusually spare, unpedalled textures, the ballad has very long spans in one pedal, which can blur on a modern piano, though we should always remember that with careful pedalling with leather-soled shoes, the dampers can be barely lifted from the strings, ameliorating the blur. However, on a piano of the period, Elgar's long pedal marks, like those of Brahms, work perfectly, without a great deal of foot finesse. It may be that some of the subtleties I detect in Elgar's pedalling marks are figments of the printer's inaccuracy. The pedal mark at the end of the second song of Sea Pictures, for instance, is simply wrong. Elgar's manuscript sketch shows that the pedal he had in mind was, for once, what one might expect. I hope to find the opportunity to see many more such pedal marks in Elgar's own hand. But for the moment, let's assume an honest printer and move on to some subtle pedal markings in the song After of 1895. The opening puts down a bass note and then adds a two-handed chord. The chord has a pause over it in both hands, but the continuing bass note, tied below, has no pause. Pedal is marked from the beginning, and the off asterisk is quite close after the tied bass note. I assume that this means... The similar passage at the end has three pauses, one for each hand of the chord and one for the tied bass note. I imagine that means... The identical effect occurs in Queen Mary's Song of 1887. That's the end of the first verse. The end of the second is more complex, as the notation shows. Clearly, it means this. I believe the same thing happens at the end of Dry Those Fair Those Crystal Eyes, written in 1899. The last bar has a tied minim D with a pause on it at the top. Underneath, a spread crotchet chord, followed by a crotchet rest with a pause on it. The pedal mark, however, extends to the very end of the bar. The fact that the pedal mark is there at all shows that Elgar did not want a clinical reading of it. But if the pedal mark comes at the end of the bar, why not write a minim chord? I take this bar as evidence that Elgar's ears were closely enough attuned to the piano to imagine a slow release of the pedal, leaving the D unsupported. It might be argued that he would have put a pause on the spread chord, but that would have implied yet a further version. Let me return for a moment to Queen Mary's song to point out the very characteristic arpeggios. These are not just to suggest the lute mentioned by the singer. They form a particular texture which works well in support of the melody, even more so on a period piano. That this was a conscious choice of a texture is shown by Elgar's exquisite piano solo arrangement of Salut d'Amour, which arpeggiates chords that in the piano accompaniment of the violin version were played straight, or as straight as anyone played anything in those days. An arpeggio in the piano version of The Last Song of Sea Pictures makes a splendid rhetorical point at bar 100. I may say at this point that I regard Sea Pictures primarily as a work with accompaniment for piano rather than orchestra. Amanda Pitt and I have given some 20 performances of it this year, and many listeners have come up to tell me how good it sounds on the piano. It contains subtle pedal effects. The blur in the first song, is not reproduced in Elgar's orchestration. Yet that blur brings so much to the song. In Where Corals Lie, the chords are marked staccato and with pedal, a marvellous effect with a delicate foot, reminiscent of Chopin's F minor nocturne, whose chords also have staccato dots and pedal, though the exact placing of Chopin's asterisks is unclear. Elgar gets round that by simply writing con ped and trusting his pianist. The apparently orchestral tremolandi can be made pianistically effective with only a little thought. A comparison with Schoenberg's Opus 1, two piano songs written at about the same time as Sea Pictures, reveals Elgar's subtlety in the matter of tremolando. The general disdain for piano tremolando shown by the more precious critics had an unfortunate outcome in the republication by Novello, 31 years ago, of Elgar's 1905 piano piece in Smyrna. It appears with the piece Skizze in a slim pamphlet oddly entitled Sir Edward Elgar, Two Piano Pieces for Piano. The opening presents an awkward mix of oscillating semiquavers in fours and a melody with triplets. The semiquavers are written out in full. In the original publication, A Christmas Annual, the oscillation is printed as tremolando minims. The prescient Elgar, in an attempt to ensure against some later editor ignorant of what the notation meant, actually added the word trem, but in vain. I gave the first performances of the correct version this summer, but I'm afraid my recording is wrong. Once you've heard this, there can be no doubt that tremolando is a legitimate piano effect. Thank you. The melody, like all Elgar's piano melodies from the Sonatina onwards, is perfectly designed for the resonance and decay of the instrument, its rise and fall. Here's the tune from the Concert Allegro, for instance. I looked at the original print of In Smyrna in the hope that it might clarify some of the pedal marks, but Niveles did manage to copy them accurately from the original print. The manuscript is at Northwestern University, so that will be a little task the next time I'm in Chicago. But though Niveles got the marks right, I fear I interpreted one of them wrongly in my recording. A semibreve dyad DA is underpinned by a crotchet rest and three staccato crotchet Ds in the bass. Under the last crotchet is a pedal mark. The next bar begins with a D major chord. The pedal off asterisk comes halfway through this. When I recorded the piece, I treated the third staccato dot as an indication of touch within the pedal and played this. But now I think Elgar meant me to release the bass D before pedalling, so that only the dyad rings on under the chord, thus. I should have realised, because the similar effect at the end I did get right on the recording. The low G in the bass is tied on to a minim and a semibreve. The minor third above it is a crotchet with a staccato dot. The word ped is printed below the low G. The staccato dot implies that one should clear the crotchet before putting the pedal down. This means that the final chord has no minor third in the tenor register, a subtle but important point. So it sounds not like this. But like this. Elgar's piano writing has the strange property of exciting intemperate criticism. Sir Clifford Curzon spoke of the rhetoric of the piano tuner so often that I've heard it from several different sources, some of whom should know better than Curzon. A recent lecture recital at the Barber Institute was subtitled Why Our Greatest Romantic Composer Could Not Quite Write for the Keyboard. Dunhill writes of the earnest ineffectiveness of the piano writing at the beginning of the quintet. Can't hear it myself. Fascinating pedal mark on the long D, presumably so that the piano can resonate in sympathy with the quartet's chromatics. The marks cancelled in time for the staccato bass. After figure two comes a good example of a staccato bass with slurred right-hand chords. Finger legato is required, and one is reminded that Elgar, like that great piano composer Mendelssohn and many others, was an organist. Another apparently otiose pedal mark on a single chord on the same page again gives resonance to the quartet. Before figure six, the quartet returns the compliment and sustains chords that the piano should lift if the pianist notices the pedal asterisk and staccato marks. A few bars later is another staccato bass with sustained right hand. Before figure 32 in the slow movement, the piano harmony is staccato while the strings again sustain, tempting during solitary practice to deploy the pedal. The second subject of the finale is an idea almost entirely of articulation that cuts across all the habits of a pianist's foot. Let me give a few examples of textural ingenuity from the violin sonata. First, a passage just before figure two, where the piano first announces a figure legato with staccato yet phrased bass. When the violin repeats the phrase, the piano plays it staccato. At figure 29 in the middle movement, the pedal mark turns what pianists would play. Or. Into a richer idea. Just before the coda and the finale, the bass is for once allowed to be non-staccato, but against carefully differentiated, shorter right-hand chords. Returning to the quintet, some of its odder pedal marks stem from Harold Brook, Novello's reader, and the man whose more than competent arrangement of the Coronation March, complete with unorthodox fingering, may have impressed Elgar enough for him actually to leave some of the details of the quintet's piano writing to Brook, inviting him to rewrite what he called the tadpole passage. And the straddlebug passages. Where Brook's contribution was merely to put a legato slur where Elgar had had staccato. I prefer Elgar's strenuous idea. Here we have the obverse of the problem we heard in Elgar's improvisation at the beginning. Since he asked for Brook's help, Elgar must have invented something he could not notate. But we only have his notated version. What might he have played? In recent performances of the quintet and the sonata, I've allowed myself some freedom with the piano parts, going beyond them in the style familiar to me from the recorded improvisations. Audiences have been pleased with the results of this approach. This is why Elgar declined Compton Mackenzie's request to record the quintet, of course, saying, "I scramble through things orchestrally in a way that would madden with envy all existing pianists." A splendid and justified bass immediately diffused by the sad remark, "I never did play, really." There's no time today to explore how it was that Elgar became so conflicted about his pianistic powers, so I'll refer you to the liner notes of my CD of the complete piano music on Elgar editions. It's all to do with Fanny Davis and the Concert Allegro, and the fact that Davis and Elgar did not meet until a quarter of a century after she had sunk the piece without trace. But there is time to give a few examples of Elgar's pianistic iconoclasm from the Concert Allegro. Curzon was probably put off by the glissando on the very first page. Fanny was doubtless appalled by the passage that seductively invites the thumb onto a black note. She accepted it the first few times, but by halfway through, she was suggesting alterations, some of which hopelessly traduce the harmony. Elgar wrote, and Fanny changed it to, that page also shows my favourite example of the non-meeting of minds, where Elgar inserts a sheet of paper solely to add a ninefold rhetorical repetition of two semitones. Above it, Fanny has written querulously, "Once!" a remark so splendidly fatuous that the British Library has not attempted to erase it. Unfortunately, Elgar bowed to her opinion, though not to the extent of publishing it. I should mention that the Novello print is inaccurate, even by its own lights. But back to fingering. The opening of the finale of the quintet, like the Concert Allegro, shows Elgar's unusual approach to fingering. This figure was conceived by someone who put his thumb under his fifth finger. This year I've been playing an unrecognised Brinkwell's piano piece, albeit an arrangement, that shows great ingenuity in arpeggiation. It's the piano version he made for The Windflower of what became the theme of the cello concerto. The right hand has to play theme and chords, which are disposed in such a way as to require a downward spread. Perhaps it was William Walton who invented the special sign for this in his Sitwell songs. I don't call to mind an earlier example, but it's good to see old Sir Edward blazing a trail for his youngers. I'm not suggesting, of course, that Walton knew this piano piece. Elgar was perfectly capable of writing superbly in the conventional piano style. This is shown by the unfortunately titled song The Wind at Dawn of 1888. Really pianistic in the conventional sense. What has been regarded as Elgar's clumsier piano writing, therefore, must be serving some other composing purpose. And so at last I come to tie pianistic iconoclasm to the subject of this conference. Where do we find piano writing with staccato basses and legato trebles, with tremolandos and peculiar pedal effects, with the idiosyncratic fingering that the composer himself preferred? Well, we find all that in this piano sonata, or this violin suite. And as to piano glissandi, what about Petrushka? But when Stravinsky does it, it's modern. Thank you for listening. This is David Owen Norris, and if you want to find out more about the music that I've been talking about, try visiting www.the-works.org. The-works.org.